I would like to send out a heartfelt thank you to everyone who's supporting this podcast through Patreon, by signing up for my newsletter or membership area on Light on Conspiracies, or any other type of support. It is extremely appreciated and really helps this show to take off the way it's supposed to do. So, thank you, thank you, thank you.
We are fighting a war. I'm convinced that it is one of the most unjust wars that has ever been fought in the history of the world.
Welcome to Light on Conspiracies, the place where truth and love transcend the darkness. Your host, Peace Award-winning researcher Ole Damagod. To listen to this full interview, just go to lightonconspiracies.com and subscribe.
I'm here today with Jaslinda Sangeera, who is an incredible human being in my opinion. As you know, I have started this podcast as a platform for people that are feeling powerless in their situation in life, that are left invisible in and without the support of family and friends, and often in a very difficult situation where they don't know how to get out of this. And Jaslinda has gone through some very hard experiences in her life, but managed to turn it around and use it as the power, as a power tool to reach out and in an effort to make real change in the world. So I just would like to make a short introduction, her background and so on, and then I would very much welcome her on the show. Now, Jaslinda Sangeera was born and brought up in Derby, a survivor of forced marriage. She is the founder of Karma Nirvana, a national award-winning charity that supports both women and men affected by honor-based abuse and forced marriages. She is highly acclaimed as an international speaker and also an expert advisor to courts in matters of child, civil, and criminal proceedings. She also chairs domestic homicide reviews and was instrumental in ensuring that all UK police forces are required to improve their understanding of honour-based abuse and forced marriages. Jaslinda has also written several books. Two of them, Shame and Daughters of Shame, have been Sunday Times top 10 bestsellers. And she's been a TED talker and, well, so many other things. Also part of a documentary called Honor Diaries that we're going to go into. So without further ado, thank you so much, Jaslinda, for taking the time to speak to us today.
It's good to be here.
I know you're very busy because there's a lot going on in these exact days. Could you tell us a little about, I think the 14th of July is a very special day for you and your organization.
Yes, July the 14th is now a national day of remembrance here in the UK. And it's a day which we campaign for, I personally campaign for across all political parties, because of the importance to have a day that honours the memories of men and women who are murdered by their families in cases of honour crimes, forced marriages as well. When these people have been murdered, I note in the last 25 years of my campaigning, nobody remembers them. Nobody in the community comes out and says that was wrong and speaks out for them. So it's important to remember them. You know, who remembers them? For me, they are the most honourable human beings. So we finally achieved a day of remembrance with a joint campaign with Cosmopolitan magazine. So now July the 14th marks the memories of men and women. It's also the birthday of Shafilia Ahmed, the murdered teenager. Shafilia was born in Britain. She went to school here in the UK. From the age of 11 to 16, her mother and father were abusing her for what they believed to be her dishonourable behaviour. That behaviour was her being a normal teenage kid. She wanted to embrace Britain, freedom, rights, democracy, independence. All those behaviours were deemed as shameful by this family, and subsequently they physically abused her, psychologically abused her. And then at the age of 16, they tried to force her into marriage as a means of getting her to conform. And Shafilia refused that marriage. She swallowed bleach as an attempt at suicide. That resulted in the young girl being in hospital. But again, the professionals, due to their lack of understanding, this is not an excuse, put her back into the hands of the mother and father, the perpetrators, because they saw them as the protective people. You know, these are mothers and fathers. They couldn't possibly harm their daughter in this way. And of course, the mother and father were saying all the right things. You know, we wouldn't force her into a marriage, we'll let her have more freedom. So Shephelia went back home, only never to be returned back into the world of Britain again, because her mother and father suffocated her to death and they killed her. And again, when I look at Shephelia Armitt's case, I remember visiting her gravestone. Her parents buried her, knowing they had killed her. And on her headstone it reads, "Here lays our beautiful daughter." And that is wrong. Thankfully, we saw the conviction of her mother and father. But I felt very strongly that people like Shephelia needed to be remembered. So the day is an opportunity also to mark her birthday. She would have been 31 in July. And also to raise national and international awareness.
I feel a bit speechless when I hear about things like this. I know that you had a major loss in your life as well in a similar situation. Would you mind telling us a little bit about your childhood and your sister and what happened there?
Yeah, I mean, I was born in England. I'm one of seven sisters and I have one brother. And England is my home. I don't know any country bar England. My parents were Indian Sikh. My father arrived in Britain in the late 1915. Like many migrants, he was invited into the UK, settled, and we were born here. So we went to school here. And I grew up understanding from the age of 8 years old that as a female, I had to behave in a certain way so not to bring shame to the front door of my family's house. So me and my sisters understood that we were not allowed to wake up, talk to boys, even be in the presence of men. By the time we were 12 and 13, we understood, you know, we had to behave modestly. We had to behave in a way whereby our parents deemed that we had a responsibility not to disrespect to our sexuality. So we were controlled in every shape or form. You know, we were chaperoned to school and back, not allowed to have friendships that were not from the Asian community. My mother used to say to me and my sisters from a very young age that wouldn't stop into our front door is that we were behaving like a white woman. And I remember thinking, you would have been taught to hate, these are bigoted views, racist views about. And yet what she was actually saying was, they were meant us. Although we lived in Britain, you know, education was deemed as a threat to the honor system. You know, and out of the more honorable world, I must keep you away from that world, even though we went to mainstream schools. So, you know, we were brought up in that way, and I watched the majority of my sisters being taken out of British classrooms at the age of 15 years old. My men had only ever been photographed. They would disappear one by one. Nobody asked any questions about their absences. In fact, the attitude 39 years ago is no different to today, whereby these young girls that went missing, the teachers looked at it as if it was cultural. It's what they do. This is a critical time of the year. And I was the one who said, no, I'm not marrying a stranger. You know, I dared to say I wanted to finish school, go to college or university. And the reason why I say I dared to say is because when you grow up within a family dynamic whose expectation it is that you'll be married to a stranger, you're not allowed to have freedom of thought or independence. Your life is mapped out for you. And it's important to make the point that women are perpetrators. You know, the key perpetrator in my life was my mother. Men are perpetrators, but it's an uncomfortable truth to have to accept and acknowledge that women are also perpetrators. So saying no, they held me a prisoner in my home until I agreed to the marriage. And when I mean prisoner, I mean locked in a room. And I'm sure I became invisible to the system, but if they'd have asked from school where I was, they'd have spoken to my parents. And my mother and father, I'm sure, would have given the awesome performance of why I was not in school. So I agreed to the marriage, and that was the plan of my escape, and I ran away from home at the age of 16. To make the they reported me to the police, and the officer, 37 years ago, but she was very clear, you either come home right away, or 5 days before, you are now dead in our eyes. And as a 16-year-old young person, that was a choice. And I have to say, there are many young people out there in the UK and internationally who are afraid of that choice. I chose not to. So from her perspective, this was the expected way of life. And anything other than that was wrong. That doesn't justify her behavior, and I forgive them both completely. But also, if my mother and father had not disowned me, because much of this is done in order to have the acceptance of other community members and family members, so they had to disown me in order to have the relationships with other family members and community members, because if they had embraced me back and I'd not married that stranger, then they would have challenged norm. and other people have seen them as wrong and disrespectful, and they couldn't take that risk. In fact, when I left home, because a promise of marriage had been made, and it's important to remember, where a promise of marriage has been made, families have to honour that promise. If they don't, you know, it is wholly disrespectful on the family. This is where they're motivated to even kill. My family forced my youngest sister to marry that stranger, and she had to marry him.
It's so strange for me. I've been traveling to, I think, some 40-odd countries, many of the Muslim countries, and most of the time I met normal people, very nice, generous, warm people, sometimes with very different points of view, of course, and different traditions and so on. But at times, especially up in the north of Pakistan and so on, I've been sitting down speaking to individuals where I felt like, are we even on the same planet?
Because
I felt there's no meeting ground. There was very hard to find sort of like, they spoke with such conviction and such strength and power in their opinions, but what they were saying was just so unreal to me. And also the way that the women were never there, they were always sort of way in the background or turned towards into the corner. So it's important for me, and I think for you as well, that these things that sounds like they're deeds of monsters are done of people that believe that what they're doing is right. It's just that what they're doing is horrendous.
They will justify it in, you know, this is parenting. They're only doing what is best in the best interest of their child. You see, the way I was brought up to believe that there wasn't equality between men and women, my behavior as a female had to be controlled in order not to dishonor the family. It was normal. These were our norms. We were shaped with these belief and value systems. So they became our rights and our wrongs. And because we went to school and nobody was challenging that norm, there was no counter narrative. I equate it to almost being radicalized, I have to say, because it's brainwashing, it is conditioning. And until somebody tells you different, you just accept it. You see, my sisters were born in Britain and they were married to these strangers without question. You know, why didn't they question it? Because to them it was normal. I can't say why I questioned it. Maybe for me it became more of a question because I was younger and I watched it happen to my sisters, and every single one of them suffered horrific marriages. The physical and the psychological abuse was horrendous. And when they suffered, my mother would go to the house and encourage my sister to stay with the perpetrator for the sake of honor. She would say, you have to try harder because this is a woman's role. So I think my age was something that had informed me as well, because I thought genuinely that this is what happens to you when you get married. And that's what made me challenge it.
This word honor is often used. What would you describe what they're doing? Would you call that honor, or what other word would fit better?
It's absolutely dishonorable, in fact. However, what we have to remember is, central to our experiences, whether we grow up in Britain, India, or Pakistan, is this concept called honor. It controls every aspect of our life. From the age of 6 years old, I not only understood the word, I also understood my responsibility to that word and how I had the power to dishonor my family. So it's central to meaning. It's central to our life experiences. So it is used to justify the behaviors, the inequalities, the abuses even. Me, my family disowned me as a dishonorable human being. That's how they see me. I have honor, absolutely. I believe myself to be honorable. But in my community's eyes, I'm not seen as honourable because I have challenged the status quo. I challenge the norm. But I say my honour is their shame. You know, honour the memories of these human beings that for me were the most honourable human beings is dishonouring them, is dishonouring the crime and the abuse. And these people who think like this, that can justify this. You know, here in Britain, it's happening behind closed doors. Whereas if you look in India or Pakistan, in rural Punjab, you know, they have the village elders who sit together, as you have described, and openly discuss. So here in Britain that is happening, but it's happening behind closed doors. And I have to say that some of the elders here in the UK are the gatekeepers. to this thinking, because I don't hear them challenging it and speaking out against it. Tazlim Begum was a young British woman who was born here in the UK, and she was born and lived in Bradford, and her brother-in-law disagreed with the relationship that she had. Now, this is Bradford. I don't know if you know, Bradford has a huge South Asian community. You know, in some areas, they are in the majority, and it's namely a Muslim community. Now, this young girl on a Friday, a very busy day in Bradford, was crossing the road. Her brother-in-law ran over her several times until he killed her. Nobody in that community was prepared to come out and tell the police they had witnessed that, even though they had witnessed that. And the next week, a religious leader here in Britain gave a quote to the local paper, and he said that was a justifiable killing in the name of honour. And this is what we're up against, where police officers are investigating these abuses, and they come across a wall of silence, because people in their family dare not speak out, in the community dare not speak out, which is why I really campaigned for forces to be inspected to improve their responses to the abuse. And sadly, I have to say here in Britain, this is in 2017, we have 43 police forces, and only 3 of those forces are ready and prepared to respond to honour abuse, forced marriage, and FGM, which is damning.
What does FGM mean?
Female genital mutilation. Okay. So the inspection of all 43 police forces looked at female genital mutilation as well as forced marriage and honour crimes, and how well and effectively they were responding to this abuse.
This honour thing, is that based on religion, or is it old traditions, or where does it come from, and where has it gained such power?
Well, first and foremost, it's not religion. It certainly isn't tradition. In fact, Gandhi, when he was talking about women and equality, he said, we will drown in a sea of oppression in the name of tradition. So what he's actually saying is people are using tradition and religion as a means to justify forced marriages, honor abuse, and abuse and gender inequality, almost as if it is written somewhere in the Quran or the Guru Granth Sahib, which is a secret of the Bible, where clearly it is not. But we're not hearing our religion speak out against it. And I go back to growing up and the conditioning of young people who are made to believe this is justified as part of their tradition, their religion, or their culture. So again, unless somebody is saying the opposite, they are God-fearing human beings, and they start thinking I'm a bad Muslim or I'm a bad Sikh if I don't go through this, etc. And that will be used in religion as a tool to oppress them. So this is clearly cultural. These are the practices of individuals that allow them to happen, and where there is no challenge, either in the family or the community, they're going to gather momentum, they're going to gather strength, they're going to become deeply rooted in terms of people's ideas, and then they become part of life. And that's why they've been allowed to happen.
In these countries, especially in Pakistan, I noticed up in the north, up in the mountainous areas, and these, my feeling was that often the man that should be the power person in the house was not at all. It was the woman and the mother-in-law. And especially the mother-in-law was like a dictator, very brutal in her opinions or her way of... Several times mother-in-laws just hit the wife and stuff like that, you know, with a stick. And this is also, I think, something that is important to be understood, that women are involved in this as well, that it's not only the men.
You see, I think if we break this down to who are the key people that are enforcing codes of honour, ensuring their daughters behave in a certain way, disciplining and punishing, it's going to be the key parents, the person who takes care of the parenting on the day-to-day. And very often that is going to be the mothers. Certainly in my case it was. So they are enforcing these honour codes, ensuring that the respect of the family and is, you know, something that they have to make sure their daughters are behaving in a certain way. Otherwise, it will fall on them. It will reflect on them. Here in the UK, I was speaking at a conference recently where we were looking at female perpetrators. Rachel Aplin is a researcher at Leeds Beckett University. She looked at 100 cases from Greater Manchester Police Force of honour crimes, honour abuse and forced marriages. And what she noted about the majority of the cases In all the cases, the victims were citing the perpetrator as being female. They were naming mother-in-laws, mothers, sister-in-laws, sisters, aunties. And she talked about how these women were the ones that had so much power within the family dynamic. And the mother-in-law became more powerful when the daughter-in-law came in. And if until the daughter-in-law has a son herself, she isn't as powerful. So there's an issue also in terms of giving birth to females, which makes you more powerful. So, you know, there is a matriarch in the family. And ultimately, go back to my life experience, my father was a very silent man behind my mother. You know, by his own silence, you could say he was a perpetrator. You know, he was complicit in this. But it was my mother that made all the decisions. She was the one that ensured her daughters behaved in a certain way so not to dishonor the family. And she was the one that enforced the punishments on us. So in terms of the who did I fear the most, and same with Rachel Apsin's research, who were these women more fearful of? It was always the mother, who also had the power to go to her sons or to her husband or uncles to say, I need your help to deal with this daughter.
Your mother, her background, was that very similar, that she was forced to marry as well?
You see, my mother wouldn't see it as a forced marriage. You know, my mother wouldn't see any of my sisters as forced. You know, she would see that as her, as tradition. She would see that, and she would say that to me. You know, I was married at 15, why are you any different? She would see that as part of tradition, and therefore an arranged marriage. You know, let's be very clear here, an arranged marriage is a tradition. You know, they happen in the royal family. They've been happening for centuries. The difference between an arranged marriage and a forced marriage is where you have an arranged marriage, there is the consent of both people. They are accepting, the family are accepting it, and they can say yes or no. And incidentally, arranged marriages here in Britain can only happen if they are 16 or above, and they have the mental capacity to make that decision. Because you cannot make an informed decision if you don't have mental capacity. So a forced marriage is clearly the opposite. Now, I always say don't overcomplicate things. This is quite simple, because a forced marriage clearly then is the opposite, where there isn't the consent of one or two people. And then what the family will do is they're not taking no for an answer, and then duress becomes a factor. Then they're forcing you to go through with it. And that's where we see the abuses, the physical abuse, the psychological abuse. The emotional guilt is horrendous in these cases, because the family have the power, because as a young person going through this, you love your family, you don't want to let them down. So they will say things like, you know, your mother will die of a heart attack and it will be your fault if you don't marry. Or, you know, it will ruin the reputation of our family and that will be your fault. Your father won't be able to put his head up high in the community, or we will lose land in India or Pakistan and it will be your fault. So you love your family. You imagine they're putting this weight on your shoulders. This is why many young people go through with it, for the sake of their families. And then the legacies continue on and on and on, and the cycle isn't broken.
So when these arranged marriages are being prepared, how do the parents, what do they use as a sort of like, who would they choose as a perfect husband for you, example?
So the thing about arranged marriages, in my experience and what I know of those I've supported, is they will identify somebody who is a suitable match, okay? And that match has to be of the same standing. They have to be the same caste. Even though the caste system has been abolished in India and Pakistan, and, you know, when I think about my own parents, Sikhism was founded on abolishing the caste system. It is alive and kicking, trust me. And, you know, you can be treated differently if you're from a lower caste. So they're going to identify a suitable match based on ethnicity, based on the same religion, the same caste, the same social standing, and preferably a man and a woman. Well, always a man and a woman. So it's not going to be, if your sexuality is that, you know, you are gay, they're not going to be looking for somebody female to female or male to male. Absolutely not. So you have to tick all those boxes first. So in a sense, you have to question, is that fair as well? And this is where At Carmen of Honor, you have to remember we support men and women, so not just women. So men can also be forced into marriages. Yes, the male experience is different in terms of their upbringing and the freedom they are allowed. Many of the men that we hear on the helpline, and we're dealing with over 850 calls a month currently on our helpline, of the 22% of male callers, the majority are men whose families are arranging their marriages, and they say things to them like, we can still have your girlfriend, but do it for the sake of the family. Or the men are gay men, and their families will force them into marriages to hide their sexuality. And that's what they will do, so that they can still show face in the community that our son is married, but hide the fact that you're gay and keep your wife. So the hypocrisy is horrendous.
Homosexuality does not exist at all, officially.
Absolutely. I mean, I hear so many cases, and the Day of Memory, you know, it is also an opportunity. We have an annual conference, and survivors are sharing their dialogues all day at the Day of Remembrance, because we're breaking the silence. You cannot argue with the testimony of somebody who's been through this. So in the face of denial, we speak to that. And these were men. These were gay men sharing their experiences, whereby they said, you know, my family ostracized me. I was whipped by my family to cure me, beaten. And one young man, Matt, who set up the Naz and Matt Foundation, he stood up there bravely and he spoke about Naz. So he fell in love with this man called Naz, who was a doctor here in Britain. And they had a relationship for 13 years. And Naz's family were a traditional Pakistani Muslim family, had very well social standing, according to them, in Birmingham. And Matt asked Naz to marry him last year. And Naz said yes. So he wanted to tell his family the truth, that I'm in love with a man, and that he was hiding this relationship from his family. So then he told them the truth, and his family told him he was diseased and he had something wrong with him, and that, you know, all the things that they say around making you feel incredibly guilty and shameful that, you know, you could possibly love a man. So Naz went back to London, where Matt was, they lived together, and sadly, tragically, he stood on the balcony and he jumped off and he committed suicide. And, you know, Matt was sharing Naz's experiences with this man he loved for all these years. And he said, do you know, Jasvinda, when it was the funeral, I begged the family to let me go to the funeral. And so in the end, they knew I was persistent and they allowed me to go. So he got to the cemetery with his family, respectfully covered his head, and they ensured they were respectful of the, you know, Islam tradition, etc. And when he got there, there was nobody there. And the man in the cemetery, caretaker, came over to him and he said, son, he said, I'm so sorry, but Naz was buried this morning. They gave him the wrong time. Because this family were more concerned, and they would have not told the community that their son was gay. And I have to say, many families, as with my family, when my sister Rubina committed suicide, and my family's view was, it was better for her to take her life than for her to leave her husband and dishonor her family. And I have no doubt, when I think about Naz's experience, his family may also be thinking the same thing.
Would it be too personal, or would you mind telling us about your sister's situation and what happened? Also, I would very much like to hear when you heard of it and how that affected you and your choice and so on.
Yeah, so my sister, Rubina, was 2 years older than me, and she was forced to marry at the age of 15, taken out of school, and she missed almost a year of her education, and nobody at school asked where she was. And when she came back to Britain, she was put back into my year at school, even though we had a two-year age gap. You know, nobody said, where have you been for almost a year? And she looked different because she had traditional dress on then, so she didn't wear Western dress. She had a wedding ring on her finger as well. So there were very clear indicators that something had happened to this young girl. But then she went off to be married to this man, and she suffered a horrific marriage. Horrendous physical, psychological abuse. And again, she was encouraged to go back to her husband. In the end, My sister was a lad back home. She was living in Toronto, in Canada, and because this is what families do. If they can't sponsor the person into Britain, they will look for other countries, like Germany back then, Toronto, or parts of America, so they can call the first foreign national from India, because it's becoming harder and harder because of immigration to come straight to the UK. So in the end, my sister left Canada, she came back to England, and my family accepted her back, and she came out with her son, who was 6 weeks old. But then she met somebody for love. Now, I say for love because it's an alien concept to us. You're not allowed to court, you're not allowed to date. Your marriages are arranged. You know, if you do date somebody and see somebody, you do it behind your family's back in secret. This is why these young girls lead two lives, one in the face of the family, one behind. So my family accepted marriage because he ticked all the boxes. He was Indian, he was Sikh, he was the same caste, the same social standing. So they allowed her to marry him. She was in her very early 20s. But their view was this, that you're having a love marriage, you have to make this work more now. So she married him, and in that marriage, my sister, she had black eyes, broken bones. My sister went to the family. It was hard for them. And I used to say to my sister, Rubina, when I saw the business, I said to her, leave him and come with me. And she would say, it's okay to say that, because you have to think about izzet, which translates on. You have to care about what people think. And she's actually right, because I was rejected by my family and disowned, I no longer put that concept before my own decision making. But here she is, putting the family and what people think before her own safety, which is what we've been taught to do. And then, tragically, in the end, my sister went everywhere for help. And the community leader in Derby, who was a councillor, a local political councillor, he became the Lord Mayor, an Indian prominent man. He again encouraged my sister to go back. And it was after he sent her back home that my sister poured fuel on her body. And then she set herself on fire and she committed suicide. And I remember hearing the news because nobody told me in my family, because I was kept out of anything to do with my family. And I remember ringing home. I was 23 at the time, and my mother was very clear to me. This doesn't change anything. I'm still disowned. I must not show my face at the funeral. But she knew I was persistent. So she said, if you do come, you must come when it's dark and nobody can see your face. And I remember for me at that point, if the horrific loss of a daughter in such a way doesn't shift the mindset of a mother or soften her heart to even welcome me back into her world, nothing is ever going to change this. And it was on that day that I finally owned the fact that I was not the perpetrator. I had not done this to my family. Because when you leave your family, you take a stand against your family. You spend many years feeling bad, feeling guilty, feeling you've let your family down. Because that's how they make you feel. And that's how you're conditioned to think. So on that day, I owned being the victim and that it's my family who were guilty and not me. It was a huge turning point. And ultimately, it was Rubina's death that was to be the catalyst for the charity, which is Karma Nirvana, because I felt strongly about speaking to her experience, and that was the first time I started to share my own personal experiences too. So it was very helpful for me to my sense of hiding, so that her death would never be in vain.
Could you please tell us a little bit about the organization?
Yeah, it was in 1993 that I established Karma Nirvana. We're in our 25th year now. For me, I wanted a charity that spoke to this experience, because 25 years ago, nobody spoke about this in Britain. I have to say, as a British-born citizen, in the first 7 years, you know, they were, are you from Mars? But this is England. This is England, you know. This doesn't happen in England. Yes, it's happening in some faraway country, you know, rural Pakistan or Kashmir or India, but not in England. This is a civilized country. And that's what they would say to me. So I became stronger in my voice. This happened to me. You know, it happened to me. So I could give that testimony, because you can't argue with that. I'm in your face, and this is the reality. So in the first 7 years, I couldn't get more than one person to hear what I had to say, but I persisted because I always believed that there were many more people out there just like me. So jump forward 10 years, and the helpline that that was established in my front room in 93 became a national helpline after years and years of campaigning. So the charity, the vision hasn't changed. You know, the mission is we want to increase reporting. We want to reduce the isolation of these victims who have multiple perpetrators. We want to save lives because these victims, they're robbed of their life. If you're forced into a marriage, you'll be raped on your wedding night and repeatedly raped. You'll be expected to stay with this stranger for the rest of your life and then have children. And it goes on and on and on. But also, we know we have to save lives because when they report, they're at significant risk and their families are also capable of murder. We know this.
You've been listening to the first hour of A Light on Conspiracies podcast. To access the second hour of this and all podcasts, please visit lightonconspiracies.com and get a membership for the price of a cup of coffee. Now, back to the show.
So, today we have the National Helpline, which was launched in 2008. This is the helpline I established in my front room. And from 2008 to 2016, that helpline has received 58,000 calls nationally. And today, we're dealing with just over 850 calls a month. 42% of our callers are professionals calling about their victim. But then all the other callers are victim callers. They're either new, repeat, or survivors calling the helpline. Because one of the important things is that, you know, we know that the awareness in the UK is still very low, despite, you know, the inroads we've made, that professionals are still dealing with this issue as different to child abuse or public protection because it's sometimes responded to as being cultural. So this morning I tweeted on Twitter a call that came into the helpline just recently. This is a police officer who rings our helpline and he says, I have a 29-year-old man with me who tells me it is part of his culture to be in a relationship with a 12-year-old girl. So I thought I'd ring your helpline because it's cultural and I have to be sensitive. And this is a real call. And it's having to deal with a professional who thinks somehow you can justify being with a 12-year-old in a relationship because it's part of your culture. And then this is an officer who is worried about cause and effect, who has been trained to be culturally sensitive, and he is concerned about being called a racist, or he's concerned about offending somebody. So he could possibly allow a 29-year-old man to be with a 12-year-old girl. Instead of dealing with this as child abuse, time and time again, whereby, you know, many of our victims report offences and professionals think, oh, I have to be a bit careful here. Because they don't see abuse, they see culture.
It's not easy to build a bridge here, is it?
I believe more and more people are talking about this today. The Day of Memory is a testimony to that. You know, we have police forces across the UK raising awareness. We're seeing calls to the helpline. We now have civil and criminal law here in this country. You know, there is more awareness definitely, but there is a lot to do. One of the areas where we're not seeing engagement, and I have put two calls into the Education Minister in the last 6 weeks, is with schools. Schools are not engaging on this issue. And yet, the victim's journey starts in education, in the classroom. If you think our whole lives are structured whereby we are controlled and chaperoned by our family, the only place we have any space for information to reach us, for any thoughts of freedom or independence, is in the classroom. Therefore, that's where we're going to vet this issue. The helpline deals with crisis. We need to deal with prevention. So we need to be in the classroom. And yet, we struggle getting to schools. We want every young person to be aware of their rights about forced marriages and the right to marry who you want to, but also the right to be born in Britain and to be allowed to embrace democracy, rights and independence. That's your right. Nobody has the right to take that away from you. So we want them to be aware of that and also to be aware of helpline. And I'm not just talking to the affected group. I'm talking to friends. You know, when I think about Shafilia Ahmed, her best friend Melissa, who I met and spoken to, said to me, Javinda, when Shafilia was going through this experience in her life, I wish I had known about her plan numbers, but also try and get this across the education.
Could I ask you about the name Karma Nibbana, why you chose that? It's a very beautiful name.
Yeah, omnibonner.uk. You know, back in 93, the videos that had a direct gave voice to these experiences, and then to evolve over time in providing direct support services and be a campaigning organisation. But I looked at the victim at first. What do we want victims to achieve? We want them to achieve a sense of peace within. Me, that's karma. And we want them to be informed, to be enlightened, and that's nirvana, enlightenment. So all it means is peace and enlightenment. And that was the vision, and that's all it means. And some people think we are a pop group. We're not. We're not part of any religious sect or organization. It purely means peace and enlightenment. And today, I'm pleased to say, you know, we've moved on from just supporting women. We support men and women. And that's really important because we're all human beings. And what I recognized was, albeit there are many women's organizations out there in Britain, because there are, men are affected. But also, as we raise sons, I'm a mother. I have a son. I have two daughters. It's important that we get sons to hear this too. And, you know, we want to move away from the brothers becoming the gatekeepers to their sisters' honor. So we've got to engage with them on the work. At the Day of Memory, we heard a man called Javid speak last week, and he shared the experience of his sister, Sobia. She was murdered last month. And he said, it's important for brothers to stand up and take a stand. And that's really important. She was murdered in a relationship outside his family. But he said, his words, not mine. He lives in the Bradford community, and he came to me for support on campaigning for his sister. And he said people in his Bradford community told him not to come to Karma Nirvana, you know, because very often communities criticize us as denigrating our communities. We should know better. We encourage girls to run away from home. We have no shame, you know, and I personally have faced risks in my life, and I'm risk assessed often because, you know, you are criticized and put yourself at risk for raising your head above the parapet. But this man came and he said, do you know, Jasvinda, the people who told me not to come, when I think about who these people are in our community, these leaders who pray five times a day, his words not mine, have long beards, who are meant to be upstanding members of the community, I don't hear them speak out against this abuse. So I'm pleased to say he stood up and he's speaking out. And that's what we need to hear more of. But that wouldn't have happened did we not open ourselves up as an organization to supporting both men and women. That doesn't just mean supporting them on the helpline. That means being open to their engagement too.
Can I go back in your personal history when you decided to say, I will go my way and leave your family? How did you do that? You were only 16. I mean, I think there would be many young women or men listening to this also that are inspired by your story, saying that it is possible, but what can they expect and how to deal with it and how to move forward?
I think the first thing to say from my personal experience is back then, 37 years ago, there was no support at all. So today, if somebody's affected, there is a lot more support available, and certainly through an organisation like ourselves. And if you are a British citizen, we also have a government forced marriage unit. So the point I'm making is it was harder then because of the lack of support. But the challenges are the same for the victim, without a doubt, in terms of what victims will be faced and what I face. So what was I facing? I was facing, well, who's going to help me? But also the reality that my family could reject me completely. And I'm going to make a decision that will be life-changing. But I was hoping they would accept me back. Now, back then, we were allowed friendships only with people from our same background. So we were not allowed to have white friends. And I had an Asian friend whose house I was allowed to go to because my mother gave me permission to do that. And I got to know her brother, who was older than me. And we were dating in secret. And he said he would help me run away from home. And that was a huge struggle, but I saw him as somebody helping me to run away from home. So I had that help. And thankfully for me, he didn't take advantage of me in any way, and we ran away from home at the age of 16. I have to say, this was not Romeo and Juliet. We were in love, and we were running away together. You know, he was somebody who helped me. And I mean, I had to do things like pack my suitcases and load them from my bedroom window with sheets, and he would collect them in the middle of the night, which is true. And then he was older, he could save some money, and in the early days, we slept in the car, but I wanted to go home. And then what happened for me was, when my mother gave me the response, you're not coming back unless you marry a stranger, I had no choice. I saw it. Remember, I was 16. I had no experience of life either. So I stayed on the other side, and I stayed with this person, and I married this person in the end. But it was doomed to fail because I was a young person, and he was a lovely man, and we have a daughter in common together. And then we separated in my late 20s. But he was somebody who helped me. But what I have to say is that when young people leave today, their vulnerability is immense. I was lucky and fortunate I had somebody to help me. Struggle was the same, you know, in the first 2 years, I was suffering from immense depression. I attempted to take my life twice. You know, they're the struggles, but the vulnerability that you have when you leave, you can attract all sorts of behaviors and unsuitable people that may take advantage of you. So it's really important for people to recognize that the alternative for me would have been, I can have my family, but it means going home and marrying a stranger. But I wasn't prepared to do that. And the other thing is, your families also set you up to fail. They expect you to fail and to come back. My mother said to me, I would amount to nothing. You know, I hope you give birth to a daughter who does to you what you have done to me. Then you will know what it feels like to raise a prostitute. I remember those words as if they were this morning. So your family expects you to fail without them, and they're expecting you to go back home. So the reason why I wanted to make the point, for me it was different, the emotions are the same, the experiences are the same, is for people to know that today there is so much more support. You know, there's helpline support. There are people that can help you plan your escape. You know, if you are under the age of 18, we can help put you into foster placements. There are refuges. There is survivor support. So it is completely different today in comparison to what it was for me.
Did you stay in the same city when
No, absolutely not. I mean, one of the things that I lived with, and victims do live with this today, is that your family are capable of harming you. Because you've caused shame and dishonor, they will go to great lengths to track you down, to find you, to bring you back, or significantly harm you, or even kill you. So you live in hiding, and I lived in hiding to start with. I lived in hiding right up until the age of 19 years old. And it's a fear you have. You know, you live your life looking over your shoulder. You think they're going to track me down one day and find me and take me back. Because, again, you know they're capable of this. I heard stories that my family had hired private detectives to track me down. You cannot live in the same city, and I would not advise people to do that. I went back to my hometown to establish Karma Nirvana after almost 9 years. But then I had that conviction with Karma Nirvana and the injustice of what happened to my sister. For me, it was important to go back and show my face. I'm not saying that was right or safe, but I had that feeling of the adrenaline was just running. I'm going to show them, I'm going to set this charity up, and I'm going to go back to my hometown because they had no right to cast me out in the way they did. And that's what I did. And I lived in my hometown for many years, and I left in my own right almost 5 years ago, but not because anybody drove me out. And that's important.
Can I salute your courage and your beautiful heart for standing up for these things? I think you're making an immense difference for many, many people in the world, both women and men. And also to have the stamina to continue, even though these powers are so powerful and so dark in many ways and so scary, that you're still standing and that you're doing it in this beautiful way. Saying that, would you mind sharing your website to the organization, whatever, and how people can support you in what you're trying to achieve?
Sure. So the charity Karma Nirvana website is www.karmanirvana.org.uk. And if you go to the website, one of the things you can do immediately, and it doesn't cost you any money, is you can become a friend of the charity, become a member of the charity. That way you are kept informed of events, what we're doing, petitions. You know, forced marriage became a criminal offence because of our campaign, yes, but people signed the petition. This is important, that like-minded people gather momentum and we take a petition with thousands of signatures on it and we show the Prime Minister, this is our power. This is not just me thinking like this. All these people feel this way. So it's important that you become a friend and you support us in the cause. And also on the website, you will see help. If anybody is affected by this, you know how to get help. And the helpline number is 0800 5999247. It's important to note that we never talk to your family. We recognize that it is family members that are doing this to victims. So it's important to know when you call the helpline or you engage with Carmen Ivana on email or anything, it is totally confidential.
Could you repeat that number, please?
The helpline number is a free phone number. It's 0800 5999247.
Excellent. Listen, in the second hour, I would very much like to hear more about the documentary Honor Diaries that you were part of and other things. And I just want to thank you for taking the time and we'll be back soon.
Thank you.
To listen to this full interview, just go to lightonconspiracies.com and subscribe. Give yourself the gift of truth and awareness while supporting Ole's hard efforts to get it out there.